Epigenetics, the crucial role of the environment. The wonderful stories about my two Guatemalan friends and that of the Canadian uncle and aunt are distinctive examples of parents or parents-to-be who have the heart to choose a new destination. They created an environment that is maximally beneficial for their own well-being and that of their children or future children. Brilliant! This seems the right moment to have a peek at a study that highlights the crucial role of the environment in cell biology. I'm talking about Dr. Bruce Lipton and his discovery in the field of epigenetics in the late 1960s. After I had first read about and studied his experiments, this was 4 years ago, I couldn't believe the mind-blowing result of his research was so little known among the general public. In my view, it should have been front-page news in every newspaper for the past 5 decades. We're going to change this for once and for all. Just imagine, the moment of the outcome of Bruce Lipton's experiments in 1968, the plaintive knockout argument, "I can't help it, it's all in the genes," actually became outdated and obsolete overnight. Genetic determinism? Exit. The word epigenetics is derived from Greek. The prefix epi meaning over or above. The implication here is that the new science of epigenetics reveals that life is controlled by something above the genes. Bruce Lipton proved that it is the environment that controls the genes, not heredity. Here's the experiment. Dr. Lipton identified a single stem cell and put it in a tissue culture dish by itself. You should know that cells divide every 10 to 12 hours. This way, after a week, there were about 50,000 genetically identical cells in the petri dish. Also relevant to know is that these cells live in a fluid that is technically called culture medium, the environment in which cells thrive. In a simplified way, one could say that culture medium is a synthetic laboratory version of the human blood that flows through our veins. Now, the task at hand is to change the composition of the culture medium. So, Lipton prepared 3 slightly different versions of culture medium by changing some of the constituents. The 3 different environments were put in 3 different petri dishes. Guess what happened? The cells in environment A became muscle. In the second petri dish, with genetically identical cells to the first, but in a slightly different environment, the cells became bone. Then, in the third dish, again with genetically identical cells, but a different environment, the cells became fat cells. Now here comes the conclusion that blew his mind. It is the environment that selects the genetic activity of the cell. This is profoundly different than the genes making the decisions as to what cells are going to be. The from that moment onward outdated creed of genetic determinism. Ergo, quote, "Rather than being victims of our genes, epigenetic science reveals that by controlling our environment, we have the power to control our biology and become masters of our fate." Unquote. Reference, Lipton and Behrman, 2011, page 63. In his lectures, Bruce Lipton aptly compares the human body to a giant skin-covered petri dish, a community of 50 trillion plus cells, all working together and interacting with each other. Lipton points out that in our human body, it is the brain that is the chemist. In other words, genes can be turned off or turned on by all kinds of circumstances and habits, by how we think, but also by what we eat, the quality of the air we breathe, whom we interact with, sleeping habit, by physical exercise. All these influences will turn these genes on or off over time. This means that the environment we create has a direct impact on the question whether a cell is healthy or sick, good or bad. A revolutionary discovery. The next thing I'd like to ask you to do, dear reader, is go climb the roof and yell this at the top of your lungs so that no one can ever say that they didn't know about it. We saw before that the physical human body is a conglomeration of trillions of cells all connected to each other and all working together with each other. And the wonderful thing is that we have seen that I am the one in charge, the one who finally creates the environment of my own body. In the early stages of our lives, the environment surrounding us seems to be rather determined by the ones we then fully depend on, our parents. But the two stories at the beginning of this chapter show that once I've grown on the path of independence, I'm the one who is in the position to choose and to take full responsibility for my own life and that of my children or future children. I have the power to decide about the personal environment that I thrive best in. Obviously, all this will be a lot easier when parents shower their offspring with unconditional love right from the very beginning, the greatest present thinkable for any child. Here, I would like to shift the focus to that very beginning of our human existence on planet Earth, where the parents-to-be are the ones responsible for who and what they bring forward. And for that matter, for the environmental quality and the parental and pre-parental consciousness they themselves have to offer. Authentic cultures, like the Aboriginals, have always been conscious of the importance of the role of the environment they create, even prior to conception. In the period preceding conception, the future parents ceremonially purify their minds and bodies. Reference, Bolton, 2016. Too wonderful not to mention in this context is the still practiced custom with the Himba tribe in Namibia, Africa. The day a woman decides to have a child, she goes into nature and sits under a tree alone. She listens until she can hear her child's song. After she has heard the song, she teaches it to the father-to-be. When they make love to conceive the child, part of the ritual is that both parents sing the song as a way to welcome the child. The song keeps playing a ritual role during the child's pregnancy, birth, and upbringing. It is also sung at the marriage and finally on the deathbed. All the villagers who know the song will come and sing it then. How more conscious and aware can a soul and a community get? Simply heartwarming. What authentic cultures obviously have always known has rather recently been studied by two pioneers in the field, Fernie and Weintraub. Their studies show that the environment created by the mother and father-to-be, even months before conception and, not surprisingly, also during the nine-month period in utero, are of influence on the mental, physical, and emotional state in which the child is born. Quote, parental influence begins long before the child is born. The circumstances under which a child is conceived, the mental, physical, and emotional state of the biological mother, the relationship between the father and mother while the fetus is in the womb, the socio-economic security and relative stress levels of the parents, as well as the mother's diet, are some of the factors believed to influence the intellectual, physical, and social attributes of the developing child. These non-genetic, non-DNA-related factors fall into the field of epigenetics. Knowing about the effects of epigenetics gives parents the opportunity, even the responsibility, to maximize the attributes through which their children will express their full potential. Unquote. Reference Verney and Weintraub, 2003, page 227. What a world of difference compared with the baggage my dear parents had to set about their task about 70 years ago. As I concluded in the opening chapter, they did a pretty awesome job, especially considering where they came from. I'm sure they were very much in love and that they cherished a dream to build a new farm together and start a family. My mother never smoked or drank, and I have every reason to believe that she took good care of herself during pregnancy and that both of them could hardly wait to welcome their first child. Although their socio-economic background is far from ideal, with both having survived life-threatening situations during a war that had ended just 4 years before their first child was conceived. It's stating the obvious that my parents did not have any books at their disposal or literature telling them how to parent or pre-parent in a responsible way, let alone that they could have even heard of a term like epigenetics. We're talking almost 3/4 of a century ago. In the early 1950s, first and foremost, it was about building up an existence from scratch, about hope and survival. Not surprisingly, my parents had one or two fallacies that this son inherited and was invited to cope with in later life. Further down, I will present some of these often seemingly innocent incidents that took place during the first part of my upbringing. Time now to take a leap to the next generation. You know, 3 decades later, it was our turn. And one more time, I would like to start with a painful confession. It's with a pretty high degree of embarrassment that I put down here that, in the presence of my dear wife and the unborn baby, I used to openly remark that I failed to see the beauty of a pregnant woman's physical body. What makes the situation even more painful is that at the time I uttered that sentence devoid of shame. Whoosh! I feel shivers running down my spine when I'm writing these sentences now. What growing older and wiser can do, I'm so happy to be able to say that today I cannot even think of greater beauty than that of a radiant, pregnant young mother. The baby room was ready nearly 3 months in advance. We had both taken part in furnishing it. As mentioned earlier in the book, Dad's mind was mainly focused on finishing his first degree studies on time in order to be ready for fatherhood before the moment the little one would be physically present. And then the cold shower, a heart-rending stillbirth. It was a little more than 2 years later when our equally beautiful second daughter was born. Oh, how welcome she was. I remember the moment we came home from hospital with Mum carrying our 2 days young miracle of love across the doorstep. While holding the baby and ushering her inside, Mum held for a moment, looked at me and said, "Joseph, are you sure we can do this?" The following reassuring words popped out of my mouth. "Dear Mum, when we can do this, nobody can do this. Look at us. You, a kindergarten teacher, me, a high school teacher. The best team thinkable." 1.5 years later, after another happy pregnancy, our family was complete. One more wonderful little sister. As to raising our kids, we mainly trusted on the baggage we had received from our parents. And I can happily say that for both of us counts that we had experienced warmth and a secure family base while growing up in our families. But unfortunately, all of this does not necessarily mean that we knew how to raise our children in a truly conscious way. Not quite. It's indeed not that long ago that I tracked down some secrets of conscious parenting, mainly connected with the postnatal years of the precious one, that I would love to share in the following pages. Sadly, neither of us had any clue about the information coming up here when we started to raise our beloved offspring. The Delta and Theta years in a child's life. Extremely relevant are the first 6 years in a child's life. Why? In my studies, I encountered eye-opening information about the importance of brain waves and their corresponding EEG frequencies, especially in the child's early development. The first 6 years, we tend to mainly operate in extremely low brainwave frequencies, between 0.5 and 8 Hz, or cycles per second. More specifically, up to the age of 2 years, in the lowest frequency called delta waves, 0.5 to 3 Hz, between 2 and 6 years, we experience theta waves, 3 to 8 Hz. These years are especially relevant because this is the period when the child actually downloads all the information necessary in later life to survive on planet Earth. Theta waves are sometimes referred to as the doorway to the subconscious. For that matter, it's no coincidence that hypnotherapists tend to bring back their client to these ultra-low theta frequencies to get access to any earlier faulty subconscious downloads. Now, the crux of the matter is that it's during these highly suggestible early theta years that a child's fundamental life-shaping beliefs are programmed into their subconscious mind. And bingo, because of this very reason, positive early parenting is so vital for the child's future. Here comes the pitfall. The infant whose brains operate in theta is unable to distinguish between information that is useful and facts that are harmful. In other words, they mainly record the information to survive in their environment, but they do not have the capacity to constantly evaluate that information. For example, when Dad remarks that little Johnny is no good or shouts that Mary's progress at school is hopeless, the information downloaded in the subconscious mind of the kid will be that of the fact that he or she is not good enough and unlovable. The same mechanism may take shape when Mum warns little Mary for the umpteenth time that if she will go out into the cold weather without a coat, she will surely catch a cold, or that when she isn't careful on the jungle gym, she will fall again like last time. A negative thought or belief like I'm guilty, I'm unworthy, I'm stupid, or I'm hopeless at reading and writing fires a different chemical in the brain's neocortex. This is how children start creating limiting beliefs about themselves, with those below 6 years of age as the most vulnerable category. The negative beliefs built up over the years, all stored in the subconscious, embody a mental image of what we think is the truth. They define who we think we are, how we perceive the world, and eventually everything we think we are, and especially what we are not capable of. For that matter, we could say that limiting beliefs constrain the victim in some way. Just by believing them, we are inhibited in the way we act, think, or express ourselves. And accordingly, this will impoverish our lives. Allow me to once more share some funny personal experiences with you that I had to endure as an under 6-year-old, highly sensitive child. As a prologue, let's start at the very beginning of my existence. In the opening chapter of the book, I mentioned that, instead of one more son, my mother had secretly but strongly wished to give birth to a baby daughter. Could it be that somewhere deep inside, little Joseph, maybe even in utero, somehow sensed that his mum, after 9 months, would have a strong preference to happily write the name Josephine on the birth announcements instead of Joseph. Who knows? What I do know is that somewhere later in life, my mother revealed that immediately after his birth, baby Joseph had to undergo surgery because he seemed to have developed swollen, enlarged breasts. And unfortunately, there was an infection. She shared with me that the subsequent surgery I had to undergo was a rather critical affair. Let's consider this one as a general introduction. Whoosh! A string of anecdotes spring to mind when I come to think of the teeter years of my existence. Here comes little Joseph's top five. I will relate them to you in a gradually increasing degree of entertainment value. I'm putting it like this because in later years, whenever I myself or one of my brothers or sisters would dish up an anecdote about any family member, it was my experience that the more hurtful an incident seemed to be for the victim, the louder the bolts of laughter they would bring about, especially at birthday parties after a good drink. There is no limit to irony. At number five. The tone of the first one is probably rather neutral. From a very early age, little Joseph was prone to challenge, especially his father's authority, preferably at the dinner table. At the same time, his taste buds turned out to be more sensitive than average. Especially on Wednesday afternoons, when we were free from school, Dad used to grab the opportunity to teach the wayward brat a lesson. My mother had cooked Brussels sprouts on the occasion. Even the thought of putting one in my mouth would nearly make me puke. Thus, it happened that at the end of the dinner session, I was sentenced by my dear dad to stay behind my plate with yucky food until the moment I would have completely finished it. And my mum was assigned the task of jailer. It was nearly 4 p.m. when my mother found it in her heart to let me get away with just taking one spoonful of it. Meanwhile, she also had conceded to alleviate the sentence and to let the single spoonful be accompanied by some sweet applesauce. And hooray, I managed without throwing up. End of sprout session. This is my number four. Another one concerned with hypersensitivity, but now accompanied with a fear factor. Most little kids are crazy about going to the village fair and love to participate in the thrilling adventures of various attractions. Not me. Not only was I not looking forward to swirling around on the back of a wood horse on the merry-go-round, just watching the thing go round and round once caused this poor lad to vomit behind the tent of the attraction. It sounds like my dad was kind of concerned about little Joseph's lack of manliness, judging by the fact that one day he seemed to have decided to cure his sissy son for once and for all. It was the moment his hands, which were like snow shovels, grabbed me by leg and shoulder, and in one dexterous movement I got planted on top of the Belgian working horse, with a back so broad that I was only able to hang on in full split position. What made the situation worse was that my four-legged friend wasn't even saddled, and there were no reins to grab hold of. The only way to stabilize and not fall off the colossus's back was by clinging to his manes. And this didn't seem enough for my instructor. Next, he commanded the horse to start walking. Oh, how deadly scared I was! The other thing that was deadly is that my dad seemed to be overly enjoying the circus act he had created. On top of that, my heroic feat turned out to be hilarious enough to be worth sharing with a broader audience at more than one occasion afterwards. Funny? Yes and no. Number three of my top five. This one is connected with my other torturer, my dear mum. First of all, you should know that my mum really had a great sense of humour and at times would laugh so hard that she finally cried out, Stop, or I'll wet my pants. The setting was our home kitchen. Present were my mother and her next-door neighbour friend, together with whom she used to have regular bouts of laughter, like the aforementioned. The occasion was that the 5-year-old had brought home his first third-grade school report with excellent grades. My mum was the first one to have a look at the school report. When she had finished, she turned to the audience present and called out, "Wow, little Joseph is such a bright student. I really wouldn't be surprised if at some point in his life he would become a mayor of a burned-down city." Next thing, both of them produced a demeaning laugh, somewhere in between irony and sarcasm. Funny? Apparently, yes. Number two. Another situation that especially seemed to appeal to my dear daddy's sense of humour. First of all, a general one that also my siblings were exposed to. Whenever one of us tripped and fell down somewhere in the public road or in the centre of our small village, the next thing Mum or Dad would do is casually look about, and subsequently they would produce the sentence, "Oh, poor boy, oh, poor girl, it's okay, just get up, nobody has noticed." A rather innocent one. Now the personal one in a similar category. Once I'd made a rather bad fall with my scooter. My left arm and shoulder felt pretty much bruised. Then, when my dad came home from working in the field, I wanted to draw his attention to my predicament. Said to him, in a plaintive fashion while producing a grimace of pain, "Dad, when I move my arm like this, it hurts so much." My dad glanced at me and dryly replied, "Then don't make that movement, son," and walked away. And there were one or two bystanders who stood chuckling in the background. Here's number one, with a bullet. One more dinner table scene. Another instance where Joseph, the rebel against authority, was taking it to the limit, determined to see where Dad would draw the line this time. I had decided that the dessert on my plate was not fit for consumption. Voiced my diagnosis across the table in a whiny, vexatious tone, supporting my head with my left elbow that I had planted on the table to the left of the plate in such a way that any eye contact with the head of the family was barred. As provocative and as plaintive as possible, I went, "Dad, I don't like this." A few seconds later, "Dad, this porridge isn't any good." A few seconds later, well timed, "It's yuck." I thought I noticed the gradually increasing frequency of my dad's breathing, sensed I was on the right track. "Dad, this is really gross." I accompanied this by a sound suggesting that I was vomiting. Judging by Dad's sudden reaction, I must have just crossed a limit. Out of the blue, my vexed dad's fleshy right hand lashed out across the table. Well aimed, it hit the back of my head, causing my face to end up flat in the porridge on the plate. When I slowly lifted my head, my face was all smeared with white mush, reminiscent of a hilarious scene in one of these silent Laurel and Hardy movies. Oops, I definitely turned out to have made a slight miscalculation this time. The interesting thing about the incident is that there has never been a single moment that I actually blamed my dad. I was simply asking for it. Had totally deserved it. When I somewhere in later life, my father must have been in his late 70s, amused and slightly giggling, reminded him of the porridge anecdote, right away a tear sprang to his eyes. Consolingly, I said, "Dad, you are bloody right. this Brad was really getting under your skin, had really taken it too far. Dear reader, I sincerely feel that the fact that in most of the examples there seems to be such a thin line between seeing the humor of it all and the harmful impact on the victim could very well testify for the notion that my parents indeed did a pretty awesome job. You should know I have some close friends who in their Delta and Theta years were presented with far more confronting stuff like sexual abuse, domestic violence, or other severe relational calamity. Yes, there certainly are many different degrees. But even though I may consider myself very lucky in comparison, the issue at hand in the instances summed up simply seems to be, at least a certain degree of, lacking parental awareness, dominance, lack of presence. How can I be so sure of the conclusion concerning the damage caused during little Joseph's TT years? Well, simply because of the result of the first ever manual muscle test that was performed on me. And this was about 60 years later, when I first met my friend Dennis Lorti in San Marcos, Guatemala. For those who have no clue about the concept of muscle testing, like myself at the time, muscle testing is a simple but very practical way to communicate with the subject's subconscious mind, a way to directly access subconscious programming. What it all boils down to is that when my conscious mind makes a statement or affirmation that conflicts with a belief stored in my subconscious mind, the resulting disharmony is experienced as weakening of the body's muscles. So, in a manual muscle test, the idea is that when the outstretched arm goes down, the subject tests weak on the affirmation that was voiced. When the arm resists the pressure exerted on it, one tests strong. It was on Tuesday, April 28, 2015, that I got muscle tested on the affirmation, "I am good." And dear reader, surprise, surprise, this poor soul's arm went down like a lead balloon. Indeed, I couldn't have tested weaker. Me, Joseph Ewalds, the guy from the Netherlands who had been a teacher for nearly 38 years, was testing weak on "I am good." And he wasn't even dyslexic. This man clearly had a severe brain imbalance. Apparently, he did not feel he was good enough. As a result of what? My mind just kept coming up with 1,000 questions. Why? How come? What to do about it? Am I happy or do I only think I'm happy? Why aren't I happy? In short, there was a lot of homework to be done. Then and there, the mind-blowing conclusion for me was that it had actually taken me more than 60 years before it finally manifested that there was something to be done about this mortal's balance. I was not happy. Implying there were aspects, limiting beliefs in my subconscious that had been holding me back all my life. Can any possible damage be repaired? The good news is that after the session, my chiropractor informed me that there are tools and ways to repair the damage. How? In Bruce Lipton's terms, every single human cell is a programmable chip, which means that once I recognize my predicament and am determined to take the responsibility for my consciousness, it is within my grasp to consciously create a benign environment for my brain cells. This reprogramming or repatterning all starts with the right mindset, a strong intention to balance the brain so as to acquire control of the conscious and subconscious mind. Simply put, every time my subconscious mind tries to come up with a judgment or a past or future fear about what I see or experience in that very moment, the trick is that I, my conscious mind, right away recognize it and change the negative thought into a positive one. And, dear reader, I can share from experience that the process even becomes fun the moment I'm able to benignly smile at my mind. Actually, in practice, I tend to say aloud to my mind, nice try, but I see through you. I smile at you. So, this was the Camino your author chose to set about on, then and there. And sure, I'm still on my pilgrimage. We're only human. Oh, and some more good news for you, recent parents, and maybe even too obvious to jot down here. For those parents reading all this wonderful news about the crucial role of a positive environment, especially in the early years, and whose beloved little one is still somewhere below six, in case you have an inkling that there might somehow have been any damage inflicted prenatally or in those first few years of your dear one, why not start repairing that damage as of this very moment? Surely all the pure love given to your baby or toddler will right away translate into more balance for each soul involved.